These are going to be miscellaneous points and authorities that are going to give you more foundation for understanding some of the legal concepts that have been applied to get an understanding of how to be free in America. Number one, we're going to define license, and you're going to find this definition in the Bouvier's Law Dictionary. That's the Baldwin Student Edition, which is a lawyer's edition, and it's annotated, and it's a 1928 edition. And you're going to find consistent definitions with the newer books, except you will find that they have been changing law books to one degree or another, hiding some of the important court cases that have ruled in the past on these particular subject matters in the benefit of freedom. And of course, you're going to find that the later law books are going to be leaning more towards a statutory construction that has to do with slaves. The definition of license: in real property law, a permission, a right given by some competent authority to do an act which without such authority would be illegal or a tort or a trespass. So what we're talking about in licensing is ownership of property. If you own property, you have a right to license someone else to be able to utilize that property. And where the government gets their licensing authority from is ownership of property. When you register property with the government, it's under their trusteeship. Now they have the right to license you to use that property that you think you own. That's why they can tell you everything that you can and cannot do with it. Now, if you want to stop getting the licenses, that's not a problem. You just first have to learn how to buy and own property. Now we're going to go to the definition of allodium, A-L-L-O-D-I-U-M, and specifically we're speaking about ownership of property in allodium. Allodium means an estate held by absolute ownership without recognizing any superior to whom any duty is due on account thereof. In other words, here's a definition of the ownership of property in a way that you have no obligation whatsoever to ask anybody else for any permission to use the property, do with it as you please, as long as you do not interfere with someone else's right to life, liberty, or property, and you absolutely have the right not to pay any property taxes on it, and no taxes are due on that kind of a property. Now, this is the type of ownership that you want to attempt to secure in the future on any properties that you want to acquire. And the elements for acquiring ownership of property in absolute ownership without owing any superior duties for using it is, number one, slaves have no right of property ownership. So number one, you have to be free. You cannot be a slave. Number two, you have to pay for it in lawful money of account with your money, not a foreign financial power's debt instrument, i.e. the Federal Reserve note from the foreign financial power of the Federal Reserve. And number three, you cannot register the property with any other authority that would assume a trusteeship relationship over the property, and of course, an encumbered with debt, school bonds to build schools. Now we're going to go to the release of powers of appointment, and in the Washington statutes in the state of Washington, you're going to find that in RCW, that's Revised Code of Washington, 11.95. This has to do with releasing a power of appointment whereby someone else is exercising some kind of a power to control you or control your property. In other words, there's a statutory procedure here to terminate the government's trusteeship position over your person and over the property. 11.95.010 releases any power exercisable by deed. And this says any power. And they are exercising a power to control you and control your property. So once again, any power exercisable by deed, will, or otherwise, other than a power in trust, which is imperative, is releasable either with or without consideration by a written instrument signed by the holder and delivered as hereinafter provided. So it says other than a power in trust, which means that if you're going to release people from a trusteeship relationship where there's a power in a trust, and you have to go directly to that trustee in order to release their power of appointment over the property. So I want to interject here now for those of you that have not listened to some of the other tapes that when you get a Social Security number, you have placed your body into what is called the Federal Reserve Alimony Corporate Estate Trust. You're in a trust relationship. There's a trustee appointed to administer your affairs. And that's why they can make determinations to lien levy and seize upon you, to take deductions out of your paycheck, etc., you know, without any of your permission. In other words, you've registered yourself with the government as an incompetent. You've told them that you're incompetent, you can't take care of yourself, that you're going to them and you're begging them to assist you in the event that you need some help to take care of you if you're disabled, to take care of you when you are retired. Next, when you register property with the state, you're putting it under their trusteeship. That's where they get the power, you see, to lien, levy, and seize the properties without any due process of law. So what we're telling you now in this section of the code, that you have the right to release them from that power of appointment and to terminate that trusteeship relationship over your person and over your property. Now, this is specifically applicable to Washington State, and you're going to find similar statutes in all the other states. I'm sure all you got to do is just look for them, you'll find them. And the buzzwords to look on a word search on a CD-ROM for the laws in your state, you would look for releases or releases of power of appointment or powers of appointment. And you'll pop up with that type of information in the code there and show you how to exercise that authority to terminate your relationship with the state. And if you don't find it there, that doesn't mean you don't have the power to do that. You still have the power as a beneficial interest holder in the trust to terminate the trustee's power to regulate that property by simply returning their beneficial interest certificate to them and reclaiming ownership and control of the property. RCW, that's the Revised Code of Washington, 11.95.020, releases, partial releases. A power which is releasable may be released with respect to the whole or any part of the property subject to the power, and may also be released in such manner as to reduce or limit the persons or objects or classes of persons or objects in whose favor the powers would otherwise be exercisable. A release of power shall not be deemed to make imperative a power which was not imperative prior to the release unless the instrument of release expressly so provides. 11.95.030 of the Revised Code of Washington releases delivery. In order to be effective as a release of a power, the instrument of release must be delivered to any trustee or co-trustee of the property and the person holding the property to which the power relates. In other words, that's directly to the people that are exercising a power of appointment over your person or over the property. You have to go directly to them. You have to directly serve them, directly tell them that it's released, and you can publish this in a public a paper. You can also file it with the county recorders, and I would advise that when you mail it to them that you do it certified, return receipt, that you follow up on it and be sure that they've received it, that they understand it, and understand that their authority over you is terminated. And any acts on their part to interfere with your right of freedom, to freedom over your person or freedom over free use of the property, as long as you do not violate someone else's right to life, liberty, and property, they'll be held responsible for. Next, delivery of a copy of the instrument of the release may be made to the Secretary of the State, which shall, from the time of delivery, constitute notice of the release to all other persons. If you're wondering at this point why we're using a statutory law as an authority for these releases of power of appointment rather than the common law, the reason for that is government employee hireling servants are bound down by statutory rules and regulations. These are the rules and regulations governing their behavior. And this specifically spells out the procedure that you have by their rules and regulations that they have to comply with to release them from their power of appointment to act in a trusteeship relationship over your person and over the property. So that's why we would use this particular authority for this particular reason. RCW 11.95.050, releases, filing with the Secretary of the State. Fee, it shall be the duty of the Secretary of the State to mark each instrument of the release filed in his office with a consecutive file number with the date and hour of filing, and to note and index the filing in a suitable alphabetical index according to the name or names of the persons or persons signing the same and containing the notation of the address or addresses of the signer or signers if given in the instrument. The fee for the filing is $1. Now, we've done many of these in Washington, and they never ask for a dollar. They ask for a worthless Federal Reserve note. Correction, they say dollar, but you give them a worthless Federal Reserve note, and they'll take it. They're not smart enough to know the difference between a real gold or silver dollar and, of course, a worthless piece of paper from the Federal Reserve. So don't pay them a dollar. Trick them and give them a worthless Federal Reserve note. They'll take it. The Secretary of the State shall deliver or mail to the person filing the instrument a receipt showing the filing number and the date and the hour of filing. Now, I want to bring to your attention that we had filed so many of these in the state of Washington, terminating their power of appointment, that they changed the procedure for doing this. They changed the procedure from filing with the secretary to making a public notice of it in the newspaper, and then, of course, serving directly the persons or person that are exercising a trusteeship responsibility over your person and over the property. Now, this does not negate putting the Secretary of the State on notice that their power of appointment is released over you. You want to still include them? Now, what they're going to do is send it back and say, we don't file those anymore. You're going to send it back to them again, and you're going to say, I'm not filing this with you. I'm putting you on notice that your power of appointment over my person and over my property is released, and you are no longer authorized to infringe upon any of my God-given rights secured by the Constitution any longer. And if you do, I'm going to hold you personally responsible. If you recall in the other tapes, we said that the USDC jurisdiction has got interstate commercial jurisdiction per Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3 of the Constitution of the United States of America to regulate interstate commerce. And this is out of the Black's Law Dictionary, and it says commerce defined the exchange of goods, productions, or property of any kind, the buying, selling, and exchange of articles. That's Anderson versus Hummel Oil and Refining Company, 226 Georgia, 252 174 Southeast 2nd, 415 417. The transportation of persons and property by land, water, and air. Now, if you look up these definitions, you're going to find that that's all for a profit or a gain. It's, in other words, it's a commercial exchange. It's not for, you know, traveling from one place or the other. It's people that are engaged in utilizing the roads for some kind of a higher profit or gain, trafficking, whatever. Now, we're going to continue on with that definition with the term commerce means trade, traffic, commerce, transportation, or communication among the several states or between the District of Columbia or any territory of the United States and any state or other territory or between any foreign country and any state, territory, or the District of Columbia or within the District of Columbia or any territory between points in the same state but through any other state or only or any territory of the District of Columbia or any foreign country. Now, that definition of commerce is a definition of that term commerce. It is not a jurisdictional definition of the District of Columbia's, that's the United States District of Columbia's jurisdiction to regulate commerce or the state's jurisdiction to regulate commerce. That is just talking about, you know, the general definition of commerce, and it is clear that commerce means for a profit or a gain. It's in a business of some sort. And the USDC jurisdiction has the power to do the interstate commercial regulatory thing between the states and between a state and the United States, which is the District of Columbia. And if we look at this, you know, even more reasonably, there's an overriding consideration here that our very, very bad government employees overthrew we, the sovereign people of the United States of America, as the sovereign rulers over our government employees in 1933 by overthrowing our constitutional republican form of government and imposing a dictatorial democracy on the people through all these social welfare programs run by these many governmental agencies. And that means they quit receiving their pay from we the people of the United States of America and started getting paid by a foreign financial power called the Federal Reserve. So, quite frankly, they're a de facto government. They are not ruling by any lawful authority whatsoever. They're not being paid to rule. They don't comply with the supreme law of the land, the Constitution of the United States of America. So that specifically nullifies them as a ruling power. I should correct that by as a legitimate and lawful ruling power in the United States of America. Now we're going to go back to the Bouvier's 1928 Lawyer's Edition Law Dictionary. The definition of commerce, which is a much more clear, more specific definition, the various agreements which have for their object facilitating the exchange of the products of the earth or the industry of man with an intent to realize a profit. So it's very clear here that commerce has to be some kind of an activity that is engaged in a profit, in other words, using the roads, interstate highways, or interstate, you know, some kind of interstate communication device for a profit that would be subject to that USDC regulation. Now, let's get into the Department of Motor Vehicles and examine why you are paying a fee to use that motor vehicle. The Department of Motor Vehicles is registered in commerce. They are an interstate commercial organization. They have compacts with all the states, which are interstate commercial compacts, and with the United States. That means they're a commercial agency registered as a commercial entity for profit for the registration of automobiles and, of course, the charging of the fees to folks that utilize their automobiles that have been registered with them. In other words, they're the trustee over the cars, or a commercial organization, they're an interstate commercial regulatory powers. Therefore, when you use their automobile, you're using their car as an interstate commercial privilege, and therefore are subject to the penalties of the trustee, i.e. the Department of Motor Vehicles, for the use of that car. That means you have to follow the rules of the road. That means you have to buy insurance. That means you have to wear the safety belt, and of course, be subject to a pullover, a shakedown, charges for violating the rules of the road, and of course, it's a total waiver of all your constitutional It's a total waiver of all your God-given rights protected by the Constitution. In other words, when you go into court and you fight some kind of a traffic ticket, you just absolutely 100% forget raising constitutional arguments to prevent the penalty from being levied. It's a railroad job. They don't go by constitutional law. They're going to go by interstate commercial contract law, which is called Admiralty Maritime Jurisdiction. Now we're going to go in the Bouvier's 1928 Law Dictionary to the definition of extraordinary, because we're going to be defining extraordinary use of the roads, because we, the sovereign people of the United States of America, own these roads. We bought them, we paid for it. Those are our roads, and we have the right to free travel on them. Now there's a such thing as what is called extraordinary use of the roads for profit in commerce, that we have a right to charge for the use of those roads because people are using the roads to make a profit on the roads. So extraordinary is defined as beyond or out of the common order or rule, not usual, regular, or of a customary kind, not ordinary, remarkable, uncommon, or rare. So if you're involved in a commercial activity utilizing the roads for profit or hire, like a taxi cab transporting people, and you're charging for that service, then of course we, the sovereign people, would have a right to charge for that extraordinary use of the roads so we can collect revenues to maintain the roads from the people who are using them for a profit or gain. But if you're simply a mere sovereign individual exercising your right of travel from point A to point B, then they have no right to regulate that except if you are using their car. Then they have the right to regulate you using their car no matter where you go with their car in the world. So if you want to exercise your sovereign right of property ownership, you have to revoke their trusteeship, own the car. Now you have, once again, the free right of travel. Now, this is an extremely powerful argument. And I want you all to know that I've been traveling now for over 10 years with no license. In fact, it's been approaching 11 or 12 years without any license, and no license plate since about 1987 in a privately owned automobile. And I've always been, I've been pulled over several times, and my papers have always been blessed as being in order, and therefore I can pass through the gate. And I want you to know that this is a powerful argument, because the nexus of jurisdiction over the automobiles for them to charge you with some kind of infraction of violation of the rules of the road comes from their nexus of jurisdiction, ownership of the automobile. So once you kill that nexus of jurisdiction, in other words, your argument now is objection on the grounds that this property is not owned by the Department of Motor Vehicles, therefore they have no nexus of jurisdiction to bring forward this action. And unless there's an injured third party to file a complaint that I injured the rights of life, liberty, and property, this case is required to be dismissed at this point. Now, many of you may be thinking that I'm crazier than a loony bird. Who knows? We're going to find right here in the Black's Law Dictionary the definition of family automobile doctrine. Now, this is a doctrine where a sovereign who is the head of the household, who is responsible for his family, is the one that has the right to determine who can or cannot use an automobile and do it without any licensing. This is a family automobile doctrine. In a number of jurisdictions, when an automobile is maintained by the owner thereof for the general use and convenience of his or her family, such owner is liable for the negligence of a member of the family having general authority to drive the car while it's being used as a family car. That is, for the pleasure or the convenience of the family or a member of it. This doctrine has been rejected, superseded, or limited in its application in most states. Well, number one, this shows that this is a pleasure type of an automobile. It's not in commerce. So therefore, it's a private family automobile authorized for travel without regulation. Now, once again, it says this doctrine has been rejected, superseded, or limited its application in most states. Well, why? The reason for that is that most people have now registered the cars with the Department of Motor Vehicles. The Department of Motor Vehicles now owns the car. Therefore, it's antiquated doctrine unless we revive it by reclaiming ownership of our automobiles and then utilizing those freely to travel. I'm going to go on with the definition. The doctrine rests upon the basis that the automobile is furnished by the husband in his individual capacity and as a common law head of the family for the use of the family and not as an agent of the community. Under the doctrine, the father furnishing automobile for pleasure and convenience of the family makes the use of the automobile by family his business, and any member of family driving automobile with father's express or implied consent as is the father's agent, and the father is liable for the member's negligence. Now, there's a lot of you that are going to be very studious. You're going to go out there to the codes, and you're going to find statutory rules and regulations that appear to require that you get a driver's license, appear that it requires you to get your car registered with the state, appears to make you required to file income tax returns and to pay taxes. Now, what you have to do is you have to look at those extremely critically and very analytically. And the reason for that is the government employees of the court system, I should say our very bad government employees of the court system, have changed the definitions of words to con you into believing something that they want you to do is mandatory rather than voluntary, in other words, not required to be done. And I'm going to start by explaining the Internal Revenue Code, Section 6012. The Internal Revenue Code in Section 6012 does not require anyone to file an income tax return because it says persons required to make returns of income, not income tax returns. So they word it in a way to make you think they're talking about an income tax return, but they don't say that. Now, I had an Internal Revenue Service agent come to my house. He said, I want to know how come you're not filing returns. I said, oh, is that right? Come on in the house. Sit down. He sat down. I went and I got the Internal Revenue Code, and I put it down in front of him. And I says, there's the Internal Revenue Code. If I'm a person required to file income tax returns and pay income tax, I want to do it. You show me in there where I'm required to do it, and I'll do it. He says, I don't know where it's at. So I went to Section 6012 of the code, and I says, well, this is where they claim the requirement is. Is that where the requirement is at? He says, yes, that's it. That's the one that requires you to file. And I says, well, read it very carefully. That says persons required to make returns of income, not income tax returns. And he rereads it. Then he looks up at me and says, well, then I guess you're not required to file. And he got up and he left. And that was the end of that, ladies and gentlemen. No more hassle from the Internal Revenue Service on income tax filing. Now, if you look at most of your codes requiring you to get a license or get a business license, a driver's license, license plates, etc., they'll all say shall, that you shall get, you know, these licenses. Now, the reason they're able to get by with that, and you have to recall that we did not give them jurisdiction in the constitutions to control our free right of travel. That's our jurisdiction, not their jurisdiction. Therefore, they don't have the authority to interfere in our free right of travel. They don't have any authority to tell us we have to sign a piece of paper on the penalties of perjury or enter into a contractual relationship with them because they're prohibited from compelling us to enter into contractual relationships, and they're prohibited from having any control over contractual relationships unless it violates the law. So here we have the definition of shall in the 1928 Bouvier's Law Dictionary. The various meanings of this word range under two general classes according as it is used as implying paternity or implying a mandate. As a word shall be born in a will, in the absence of a context, are words of futurity. And where a statute declares a thing shall be done, the natural and proper meaning is that a preemptory mandate is enjoined. Which see four classifications of cases in which the word has been held to be used in a directory and others in which it has been held to be used in a preemptory sense. Now here's the key definition of shall. I was going to get just to this, but I didn't want to leave that other out so you would understand with the general definition as opposed to using in a specific definition that would have some kind of a conflict with the Constitution of the United States of America, because that the Constitution bars government employees from interfering in our jurisdiction. So here's the definition you want to hone in on. It is held in the United States that it is to be construed as may, unless a contrary intention is shown. In other words, unless they show that it's mandatory, it's required by law, then the correct definition of shall is may. It's voluntary. It's not mandatory. They cannot enforce it as mandatory because they do not have the jurisdictional authority to interfere in our jurisdiction. So what they're doing by using the word shall, they're conning us into believing that it's mandatory when it's not. And it's up to you to expose that and say, wait a minute, the shall here means may because it interferes with my free exercise of my God-given rights secured by the Constitution. Therefore, you don't have any jurisdictional authority to compel me to do what you're asking. Now, if they proceed to try to enforce a statute with the word shall and against you is mandatory, where they're absent constitutional jurisdictional authority, now your assertion is that they have exceeded their jurisdiction, they're in breach of their contract, and then you have to hold them liable for that breach of contract. I've talked a lot about trust. You have a trust tape there. I want you to go through it. And we do a couple of different kinds of trust. And the primary one that we do is in the common law jurisdiction without any registration with any government agency. No taxpayer's identification numbers. No requirement to file or to pay these taxes. Now, I'm going to bring you to the definition of common law. And this is in the Black's Law Dictionary. Correction. This is out of the Bouvier's 1928 Lawyer's Edition Dictionary. Common law, that system of law or form of the science of jurisprudence which has prevailed in England and in the United States of America in contradistinction to other great systems such as the Roman or the civil law. In other words, common law is in contradistinction to other types of laws, for example, statutory rules and regulations. It goes on to say, those principles, usages, and rules of action applicable to the government and security of the persons and the property which do not rest for their authority upon any express and positive declaration of the will of a legislature. Now, with this definition, you should see the power of a trust written in the common law jurisdiction, which is our jurisdiction, not their jurisdiction. And they don't have any right to infringe upon our jurisdiction. Okay. In other words, the legislative bodies do not have the authority to regulate a common law trust because this is written in the common law jurisdiction. It is not registered with the government. It does not have a taxpayer's identification number. It's not required to file or pay a report. And the common law is a separate and distinct law, separate and in contradistinction to the statutory rules and regulations that the legislative bodies pass. Legislative bodies pass legislative acts to control enclaves that were created by a statutory will by the legislative bodies. In other words, it's a privileged organization that is privileged or benefited by the state. Therefore, the state legislative bodies has the right to rule things that they privilege. If you are not a privileged slave of the state and you are functioning in common law, the legislative statutory rules and regulations have got absolutely no jurisdictional authority to govern you. So what we're doing is we're moving ahead to resurrect the full use and implementation of the common law so we get back to utilizing our common law rights in order to conduct our personal and free enterprise affairs totally outside the jurisdictional authority of the state so that once again we can be sovereign and free over our state employees and over the United States employees. Now we're going to go to the definition of driver, one employed in conducting a coach, carriage, wagon, or other vehicle with horses, mules, or other animals. The key to this definition is one employed. In other words, a driver is someone that works for hire to transport goods or persons for a salary, for a fee. Since they are engaged in an interstate commercial regulatory jurisdiction, since it's commerce, since they're using the roads, then they have an obligation to be qualified to be sure that they're a safe driver in order to be able to carry those passengers. The definition of driver does not apply to people who are sovereign over the government employees, who own the automobile, that is not registered in commerce with the state, because you are not being paid to transport someone else. Now we're going to go on to the definition of the passenger. That's one who has taken a place in a public conveyance. Well, a public conveyance is one for hire by virtue of a contract for the purpose of being transported. And, of course, transported means that you're being transported for hire from one place to another on the payment of a fare or of its equivalent. So, once again, passengers are people who are paying a fare to be transported. So if you're carrying someone else in your automobile from one place to another, and they're not paying you to do that, they are not a passenger, they are a guest. This is in Friedhoff versus Ingberg, 82, South Dakota, 522, 149, Northwest 2nd, 759, 761, 762, and 763. The essential elements of passenger as opposed to guest under guest statute are that the driver must receive some benefit sufficiently real, tangible, and substantial to serve as the inducing cause of the transportation so as to completely overshadow mere hospitality or friendship. It may be easier to find compensation where the trip has commercial or business flavor. So here we see a very, very clear understanding as a difference between a passenger for hire and a guest who is a family member or someone else that wants to just ride along with you. As I explained in some of the other tapes, that when you place property into a trusteeship, you become the beneficial owner of the certificates of that trust. In other words, you're not the absolute owner of the property. Now you have an equitable interest in that property. Now here's the legal definition of beneficial owner, and you might want to see also beneficial owner or equitable owner. Equitable owner, one who is recognized in equity as the owner of property because the real and the beneficial use and title belong to him, although the bare legal title is vested in another trustee for his benefit. Now that's what happens when you register the car with the state. They become the trustee who supervises the use of the property for your benefit. In other words, they tell you what you can and can't do with it. One who has a present title in land which will ripen into legal ownership upon the performance of conditions subsequent. There may be, therefore, be two owners in respect of the same property, one the nominal or legal owner, the other one the beneficial or equitable owner. So you would be a beneficial equitable owner of the automobile, not the owner in absolute ownership with the title in allodium. The state would have the trusteeship over it and the power to control you, whether it's a registered car or a registered piece of property with the state. Yep. Now here's another definition of licenses by court decisions. A personal privilege to do some particular act or series of acts on land without possessing any estate or interest therein, and is ordinarily revocable at the will of the licensor and is not assignable. The permission by competent authority to do an act which without permission would be illegal, a trespass, a tort, or otherwise not allowable. Certificate of the document itself which gives permission. Thing, correction, leave to do thing which licensor could prevent. Permission to do a particular thing, to exercise certain privilege, or to carry on a particular business, or to pursue a certain occupation. Now, I'm going to just put it plainly and boldly to you. If you learn how to buy and own an automobile, now you have a right to license yourself to use it according to your rules and regulations and license other people to use it according to your rules and regulations because you're the owner. You have a right to license other people to use property that you own. Now, this is a really serious thing that I'm talking about here because our very, very bad government employees have entered into a conspiracy that has stripped us of absolute ownership of all properties that we have worked for all of our lives and tricked us into a trustee relationship with them so they can tell us everything in the world we can and cannot do with them and charge us a fee every year to use those properties that we're working like a dog to pay for it. So this is an extremely serious matter, and you cannot have a free country without the right to own property with absolute ownership, with free use of it, with no taxation. And the reason for that is through taxation, the government actually consumes the value of the property every 100 years through taxation, which means they are destroying wealth. That means you cannot accumulate a large estate. That means you don't have a large estate to pass on to your family members. That means we're going to have a lot of bankruptcies. And so prosperity is not going to be a great factor in a country without absolute property ownership. Okay, a lot of people are worried about, well, how are we going to control property then to make sure people don't put up things that would harm the environment? The common law will take care of that, because if someone does anything that would infringe upon someone else's right to life, liberty, and property, then you have a right to settle that in a common law court and correct the issue like civil human beings. We don't have to have this myriad of government agencies all over the place and wet behind the ears college students that are green coming around telling us what we can and cannot do with properties that we've worked for, that we've paid for with our sweat and blood, that we care about enough to be able to protect and utilize in a responsible manner, and then have them, you know, act like a dictator over our individual persons and properties. I'm going to read from an authority that talks about the executive orders to help establish a dictatorial global government. Article 1 of the Constitution for the United States of America explicitly mandates that only Congress shall make federal laws. But in spite of this mandated restriction since 1932, every president has usurped lawmaking powers. They called their laws executive orders, indicating that they have violated the Constitution and their oaths of office in order to gradually place our former free America with a dictatorial global government to be ruled by foreigners in the United Nations. Apparently to avoid arousing we 250 million Americans to what is being planned for us, none of the numerous executive orders have been widely publicized, but they are all printed in the U.S. Federal Register and have the force of law when activated by a president. Listed below are just a few that can enable a president to become a dictator, each of which is listed by executive order number. 10995, federal seizure of all communications media in the United States. 10997, federal seizure of all electric power, fuels, and minerals in public and private. 10998, federal seizure of all food supplies and resources, public and private, all farms and farm equipment. 10999, federal seizure of all means of transportation, including personal cars, trucks, or vehicles of any kind, and total control over all highways, seaports, and waterways. 11,000, federal seizure of the American people for workforces under federal supervision, including the splitting up of families, if the government so desires. 11,001, federal seizure of all health, education, welfare facilities, both public and private. 11,002, empowers the Postmaster General to register all men, women, and children in the United States of America. 11,003, federal seizure of all airports and aircraft. 11,004, federal seizure of all housing and finances. Authorities to establish forced relocation, designates areas to be abandoned as unsafe, establishes new locations for the populations, relocate communities, build new housing with public funds. 11,005, seizures of all railroads, inland waterways, and storage facilities, both public and private. 11,051, provides the Office of Emergency Planning, FEMA, F-E-M-A, complete authorization to put the above orders into effect in times of increased international tension or economic or financial crisis. Meaning that if they perceive something to be a crisis, they can put forth a dictatorial power against we the people of the United States of America, totally strip us of all our rights, separate us from our families, put us to work in work camps, wherever they want to put us to work at, and control the distribution of all of our food and other resources. This is an unconstitutional, criminal usurpation of power that was never granted these people in the Constitution. Just writing these things is a treasonous act against we the people of the United States of America. And I read this into the tape so you'd be aware of the fact of how far they have gone to subvert our jurisdiction. As a refresher, Article 10 of the Constitution of the United States of America, which is considered to be the 10th Amendment, which is part of the Bill of Rights, says the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited by the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. What that means is whatever powers we did not give to the federal and the state governments, they don't have, those are our powers. And it means that whatever powers that we gave to the state has, and they have no other powers. And since we delegated powers to the United States to perform specific duties and responsibilities for us, the reservation of the rest of rights were to the states and to the people, then we gave up some to the states and reserved the rest to ourselves. Just to show you how seriously powerful the 10th Amendment of the Constitution is in the Bill of Rights, the state of Colorado has put the federal government on notice to get out of their jurisdiction, to stay out of their backyard. Now, this is the same notice that we all need to give to the state governments and the federal governments, to get out of our backyard, to get out of our jurisdiction. And I'm going to read this into the tape for you so you'll be aware of this very important act. Whereas the 10th Amendment of the Constitution of the United States reads as follows: the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution or prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. And whereas the 10th Amendment defines the total scope of federal power as being that specifically granted by the United States Constitution and no more. And whereas the scope of power defined by the 10th Amendment means that the federal government was created by the states specifically to be an agent of the states. And whereas today in 1994, the states are demonstrably treated as agents of the federal government. And whereas numerous resolutions have been forwarded to the federal government by the Colorado General Assembly without any response or resolve from Congress or the federal government. And whereas many federal mandates are directly in violation of the 10th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. And whereas the United States Supreme Court has ruled in New York versus United States, that's 112 South CT period 2408, 1992, that Congress may not simply commandeer the legislative and regulatory processes of the states. And whereas a number of proposals from previous administrations and some now pending from the present administration and from Congress may further violate the United States Constitution. Now, therefore, be it resolved by the House of Representatives of the 59th General Assembly of the State of Colorado, the Senate concurring herein, that the State of Colorado hereby claims sovereignty under the 10th Amendment of the Constitution of the United States over all powers not otherwise enumerated and granted to the federal government by the United States Constitution, that this serves as notice and demand to the federal government as our agent to cease and desist effective immediately mandates that are beyond the scope of its constitutionally delegated powers. Be it further resolved that copies of this resolution be sent to the President of the United States, the Speaker of the United States House of Representatives, the President of the United States Senate, the Speaker of the House, and the President of the Senate of each state's legislature of the United States of America and Colorado's congressional delegation. This is signed by Charles E. Berry, Speaker of the House of Representatives, Judith Rodriguez, Chief Clerk of the House of Representatives, Tom Norton, President of the Senate, and Joan M. Alibi, Secretary of the Senate. I guess she's had an alibi all of her life. Now, back up to this one part here. We see that the state of Colorado claims sovereignty via the 10th Amendment over all powers not otherwise enumerated and granted to the federal government. Okay, now, here's a fraud here. You see, the state of Colorado is rightfully claiming powers that we didn't give the federal government, but it only has the powers that we delegated to it in the Constitution. All the other powers were reserved to we the people. When they say they're claiming authority over all powers not delegated to the federal government, they're claiming that they are in charge of and in power over our jurisdiction. So they made a mistake in doing that. Now, everybody has got to do the same thing. We've got to say, okay, fine, the 10th Amendment of the Constitution prohibits the state of the United States governments from interfering in our jurisdiction, and we have to tell them to get out of our backyard. And you do that by simply not complying with any of the rules or regulations that are in violation of your God-given rights secured by the Constitution. And you find out what those are by looking at the constitutional delegation of authority that we gave them in the Constitutions, and whatever we did not give them in the Constitutions, they don't have a right to do, that's our jurisdiction. If we did not give them the right in the Constitution to regulate our free travel, they don't have the right. If we did not give them the right to control our use of firearms for defense, they don't have that right. If we did not give them the right to control our labor in the Constitution, they do not have that right. And you will find their claims of rights to do that in statutory rules and regulations are embedded with the word shall, which means may, when it concerns God-given rights that are secured by the Constitution. Now we're going to go to session number 5, which is the review, test, questions, and answers. Test. Do you know the difference between slavery and freedom? Do you know where you are, and do you know where you wish to go? Are you prepared to make the effort to obtain freedom and to enjoy the blessings of liberty? The first part of this test is recognition, number one. And by the way, recognition means that it's very, very important for you to recognize where you're at, because if you don't know that you're a slave, you have no capacity to change out of slavery and into freedom. That is, if you are a slave. So number one, I am a slave of the state. Well, if you have a Social Security number, yes, you're a numbered slave of the state, and when you have a Social Security number, they have the rights to the first fruits of your labor. So if you have a Social Security number, you'd have to say true. If you're totally void of a Social Security number, You don't owe anybody anything, then you could say false. Number two, I own a home. Well, if you have the home registered with the state, if you have to go to the state to get permission to make an addition on the house, then you only have illusionary ownership, which is equitable interest, not absolute ownership in Lodium. So therefore, you'd have to say false. Number three, I own a car. Well, now you can only say that you own a car if you have a right to do with it as you please, as long as you do not interfere with someone else's right to life, liberty, and property, and if it was not registered with the state. As soon as you register with the state, it becomes their property. You have illusionary ownership. You actually have equitable interest in that car, not ownership, so therefore you'd have to say false. Four, I own personal property. Well, if you're a slave of the state, slaves have no right of property ownership, number one. Number two, if you bought it with Federal Reserve notes, that vested ownership in the Federal Reserve, a foreign private corporation, they have the power to remove it from you without any due process of law. Next, five, I own Federal Reserve notes. Well, Federal Reserve notes are created on a printing press operation by a foreign financial power, the Federal Reserve. They do not sell them into circulation. They rent them into circulation. So since they do not give up ownership of those notes, you have to pay a rent charge on them. The rent is interest to the federal government. Therefore, you cannot claim ownership of any Federal Reserve notes, not even one, even if you worked all your life for just one Federal Reserve note. By the way, Federal Reserve notes are those things that the government refers to as dollars that are not dollars because they're not gold and silver. They're repudiated notes of the Federal Reserve. In other words, they've refused to redeem them in lawful money after they stole all lawful money by introducing those in the economy for real money. Number six, I own my own body. You cannot claim ownership of your own body unless you're getting a full paycheck with no deductions. If deductions are coming out of your paycheck before you get it, that means someone else is claiming ownership of your labor and has the right to take a piece of your labor before you get paid. So if you're working for wages for someone else and you have deductions, they're claiming ownership over your body. Now, if that's happening, that should upset you, that someone else is claiming ownership over you and having the power to determine how much of your earnings they get to keep for themselves and how much you get left over. And you're going to find a good explanation for that in Genesis 47. Number seven, I have no debt. Most people have to admit that they have debt, but there are people that have no monthly bills, but they still have a Social Security card. If you're a Social Security card carrying Communist of the USDC jurisdiction, then you owe your fair share of the national debt to the Federal Reserve. Therefore, you'd have to say false because you would have debt. Number eight, my government employees work for me. Well, they're not working for you because they're working for the Federal Reserve. Evidence, they're being paid in Federal Reserve notes by the foreign financial power, and that's why they're not serving you. And if you ever stop to think about this, they shouldn't be serving you because you're not paying them. If we were paying them, we'd be paying them in lawful money account, gold and silver coin, per Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution. Number nine, my government employees are paid by me to work for me? Of course not. They're being paid by the foreign financial power of the Federal Reserve. 9A, we currently have a representative constitutional form of government. That is absolutely false. Number 10, I have the right to do as I please with my home. That's false because you do not own a home. I have the right to do as I please with my motor vehicle. That's false because all motor vehicles are owned by the Department of Motor Vehicles. That's why a car is labeled with the title motor vehicle, because it's owned by the Department of Motor Vehicles. As soon as they acquire an automobile, it changes the name and description of the automobile to a motor vehicle. 12, I have the right to do as I please with the benefits I receive from my labor. That would be false if deductions are being taken out of your paycheck before you receive it. 13, I owe my servitude to whomever I receive my benefits from. That's true. 14, whoever has the gold makes the rules. That's the golden rule. That is true. Number 15, I own no gold. Well, that would be true if you're a slave, because slaves have no right of property ownership. In other words, if you're a slave and you've got tons of gold and silver in your basement, you still cannot claim ownership of it because you're a slave and slaves have no right of property ownership. You can't claim ownership of gold until you're free. By the way, the evidence of that is if the government decides to raid someone for any particular reason, the things that they'll steal first, they'll steal the guns, they will steal the computers, and they will steal the gold and the silver, and they will steal the Federal Reserve notes. So they'll steal anything that has value. 15A, earn money exchanged for my labor. That's false because you're probably getting Federal Reserve notes for your labor, not gold and silver. And I've done both. I've gotten gold and silver for my labor and also Federal Reserve notes. 16, I depend upon God for my benefits. Well, I would like for that to be true. And, of course, there's people that don't believe in God, and that's their right to do that. And there's no criticism there, of course. I have a right to believe, and you have a right not to believe, or et cetera, vice versa. Number 17, I depend upon the state for my benefits. That would be true if you have a Social Security card. That's you are a benefited slave of the state. You do have a right to go to them for benefits. And if you get rid of it, that would remove that that benefit privilege. 18, the first fruits of my labor go to God. That would not be true if you're working for earnings and having deductions coming out of your check. In other words, the state has already taken the first fruits of your labor, therefore you don't have the first fruits to give to God. And it's impossible to give your first fruits to two different people. Number 19, the first fruits of my labor go to the state. That would be true if there's deductions out of the paycheck. I can give my first fruits to both the state and God. No, that's impossible, because how can you give one thing to two different people? Number 21, I can serve two masters. Of course, that's false. That's Matthew 6:24. The Bible tells us that we cannot serve two masters, because we're going to hate one if we try to. And if you've been hating the government, if you had this kind of a feeling of hate for the government because of their tyranny, well, that's because your spirit is contrary to the ways of the democracy. You want to serve God, you don't want to serve the state, but yes, you feel like you're being compelled to serve the state contrary to God's will, so therefore you feel like you're being torn in two and you're upset and you're angry. Well, I can guarantee you, once you stop serving the state, you will relieve yourself of that hate for the government, you'll feel free again, and you'll be happy again, and you'll be like a renewed individual. Number 22, I have the power of choice to serve God or to serve the state. That's true. 23, I've chosen to serve the state. Well, if you have a Social Security card, deductions out of your paycheck, if you're getting loans and all that kind of a thing, yes, you have chosen to do that. There's no law that requires you to serve the state. Therefore, it was done by you on a voluntary basis. Now, it might have been done through ignorance, but remember Hosea 4:6, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. It's our responsibility to get knowledge, and if we fail to do that, that's our responsibility, not anybody else's. And we have to make the correction. And what I'm showing you here is that the correction is without our jurisdiction. The power to change is without our jurisdiction. We're the ones that put ourselves in a bondage, which means that we're the ones that have to get us out of bondage. Number 24, there are only two forms of government, man's and God's. Okay, I'm going to say that's true. Those that don't believe in God will probably disagree. But I just want you to know that I want to come together with people on some common interests here. And just because I believe in God doesn't mean I have any interest in excluding people that don't. 25, I want to repent and change to serving God. I would hope that that would be true. 26, I am internal to the Internal Revenue Code. Well, if you are participating in one of the programs that the Internal Revenue Code governs, like Railroad Retirement Act, Social Security, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Licensing, like an interstate commercial regulation, then yes, you would be internal to the Internal Revenue Code. 27, I'm external to the Internal Revenue Code, which means that if you're not participating in sections of the code that the code governs, then you are external, not internal. Therefore, the Internal Revenue Code does not apply to you. And I just like to say right now that the Internal Revenue Code does not apply to me. I'm external to the code. I'm not a benefited slave of the state. 28, I am a card-carrying member of the USDC Communist Party. If you have a Social Security card, remembering that the 10 planks of the Communist Manifesto are being enforced upon Social Security card-carrying members of the USDC jurisdiction, then you're a card-carrying communist of the USDC Communist Party. So that would be true if that's the case. If you don't have a Social Security card or number, then that would be false. Now we're going to go to contracts, number one. Article 1, Section 10 of the United States Constitution prohibits government from interference with rights of contract. That's true. Number two, the 10th Amendment of the United States of America Constitution reserved all rights not delegated to the governments to the we of the people. That is true, extremely important. Understand that whatever powers we did not delegate to them, we reserve, which means that all you got to do to find out what your power is go to the Constitutions and see what we gave up to government employees, and we have everything else. Now you have the power to tell them to get out of your backyard, because they have no constitutional authority to be there. Anytime they want to interfere in your life, you say, wait a minute, I want you to show me the constitutional authority that allows you to ask me these questions, allows you to impose these rules and regulations upon me. And if they cannot show you the constitutional authority, then they don't have any right to do that. They're in breach of contract if they swore to uphold the Constitution as the supreme law of the land. And you might want to ask them for the document whereby they did that. Number three, we have the right to contract with mere corporate entities. That's true. Four, I'm the only one that can change my contractual relationships. That's true. By the way, a corporate entity is the United States corporate USDC jurisdiction. They're the ones that are selling that insurance called Social Security. And you contracted with that jurisdiction when you got the Social Security card. So you don't have any responsibility being in that contract because it was brought upon you by fraud or misrepresentation. And all contracts brought upon you by fraud are voidable at the outset because they're null and void. So, yes, you have the power to change that contractual relationship. You're the only one. If you want it to be done, you have to do it. Five, the original constitutional authority of the USDC jurisdiction is D.C. 10 miles square plus its possessions and interstate commercial regulation. That's true. That's a very limited jurisdiction, which means they have no entree into your backyard unless you contract with them, like through the Social Security number. Six, I am within the jurisdictional authority of the USDC jurisdiction. That's true if you've contracted with them via the Social Security number. Now, I want to give you an example of this. I go to France, and I make an agreement with France to borrow $100 million, and they loan it to me. And the conditions are that I have to repay that $100 million, and anything I use to buy it is collateral for the repayment of the $100 million. So I take the $100 million, I come back to the United States, and I say, okay, France, I'm in the United States now. I don't owe it to you because I'm outside of your jurisdiction. Would that be a lawful argument? Of course not. Why? Because I made the agreement to pay it back. That's a contractual obligation that I've entered into. No matter where I go in the world, I still have the responsibility to pay it back. It's the same thing when you can contract with the USDC jurisdiction. Even if it's a foreign jurisdiction to the state jurisdiction to the people's jurisdiction, you went into that jurisdiction, you contracted with them to get the Social Security number. Now you have to pay the penalty for the benefits you made yourself eligible for. So you're within that jurisdiction if you've contracted with them for benefits. Seven, by contractual obligation, I am either an employee, instrumentality, or both of the USDC jurisdiction. Once again, that would be true if you have a Social Security account number. Eight, I can't claim I'm foreign to entities I voluntarily contracted with. That is true. Nine, it is ridiculous to contract with government employees for benefits. That's true. You never go to your servant and ask for your servant to benefit you unless you want to make your servant your master. Ten, government employees were hired by contract to serve me. True. That contract is the Constitution's. 11, government employees serve me. False, because they're not your government employees. They are government employees working for the Federal Reserve, a foreign financial power, to enforce the rules and regulations of that institution through the banking system. That is correct. The banking system is what is used to enforce the Internal Revenue Service Code. Proof source, if you go to the bank to open up a checking account, the first thing they're going to require is a Social Security number to get the account, or a taxpayer's identification number, or an employer's identification number, or all of the above. The reason they do that is because the income tax structure supports the counterfeit banking operation. If they didn't have the income tax to rob the producers of the wealth because the government got something for nothing, then the counterfeiting operation would collapse. Well, the supporters of the counterfeiting operation are the banks. So the banks are the ones that are enforcing all these penalties against us. And being enforced, and I should say the enforcement agency, to make sure that it works correctly is the Internal Revenue Service to do the threatening, intimidating, and harassing. But if you just take a look, if you're a businessman, if you take a look at who it is you're making your deposits with, of all these taxes, you're going to find out they're going into the Federal Reserve banks. 12, I am required by law to enter into contracts with all mere corporate agencies of government by signing all pieces of paper they place in front of me. That's false. 13, the Constitution prohibits government from interfering with individual rights to bear arms, weapons without infringements. That is true. 13A, those constitutional provisions are, well, number one, the Second Amendment of the Constitution provided the people to bear arms without infringement. Number two, the 10th Amendment of the Constitution, whatever powers we did not give to the government they do not have, meaning that we never gave them the power in the Constitutions to control our use of firearms to defend ourselves. Therefore, they don't have the power to do that. This con job to con people into believing that we don't have any right to bear arms and arms cause deaths, and therefore we should not be allowed to have them is total baloney. It's not firearms that cause deaths. It's people that cause deaths by the misuse of firearms. And if you don't think that we should have firearms to defend ourselves, then why is it all these police officers out there are armed to the hilt to defend themselves? The reason that they are is there are all kinds of criminal elements out there, and if they don't have the arms to defend themselves, it's likely that they'll come out the loser in any kind of a confrontation. So we have a right as sovereign people of the United States of America to defend ourselves as well. And I'm not talking about, you know, being irresponsible with it or injuring someone with it unnecessarily. I'm saying we have a right to bear arms, to defend ourselves and our families against someone that might want to break into our homes and rob us of our possessions or to take one of our lives. Number two, you can't buy something with something you do not own. That is true. Three, sovereigns do not register their property with their servants. That is true. Four, registration of property places that property in a trusteeship. That's true. Five, we the people have the right to revoke U.S. government's trusteeship over registered property. That's true. Six, the color of money is green. That's false. It's gold or silver. Okay, next session. I can be free if I want to be free. Number one, I voluntarily chose to serve the state. Okay, now this is confession time. We all want to remember that confession is good for the soul. If you can confess the things that you did wrong, then you have the power to make the correction. If you can't come to this realization that you did these things wrong, then you have no power of correction. Once again, one, I voluntarily chose to serve the state. At one time, most of us did, so that would be true. Two, the law requires that I obtain a Social Security account number. That's false. 2A, the law requires that I use a Social Security number. That's false. 2B, the Social Security number identifies me and my children as slaves of the state. That's true. 2C, I sold my children into bondage for a tax deduction. For most people, that's probably true. It's false for me. I was able to raise two children with no Social Security numbers, and I praise the Lord for that opportunity. 2D, I'm required by law to sell my children into bondage for a tax deduction. That is false. 3, the law requires that I become a taxpayer. That is false. 4, the law requires that I sign all commercial contracts offered by the state. That's false. 5. Genesis 47 explains how the Egyptians sold themselves into bondage for benefits from the government. That's true. 6. Government is only sovereign over the numbered slaves that are eligible for benefits. That's true. 7. Genesis 47 explains that only property given in trade for benefits became the property of the Pharaoh. That's true. 8. Oh, and incidentally, that's your eternal proof source that you don't have any obligation to pay any property tax if you own property. And if you're paying property tax, that means you do not own the property. 8. Genesis 47 explains that the priests worked for the Pharaoh. That's true. 9. Genesis 47 proves that if you pay property tax, you do not own the property. That's true. 10. State licensed ministers serve the state, not God. That's true. 11. State licensed churches are business organizations doing business as a church. That's true. 12. State licensed ministers and churches teach obedience to the state. That's true. 13. Matthew 6:24, you can't serve two masters. That's true. 14. The state was created by man, not God. That's true. 15. The state is in fact a mere corporation due to its operation in commerce. That's true. 16. The state is involved in criminal activity and has no characteristics of God's government. That's true. 18, 1 Samuel chapter 8, is evidence that man has and does create his own government contrary to God's will. 18, the state is a lower power from man and not a higher power from God. That's true. Next session, the steps to freedom are, number one, cease to use all benefits offered by the mere corporate state. True. Two, God's people are not debtors. Get out of debt. That's true. Three, cease the practice of entering into contracts with the state. That's true. Four, do not sign any state-offered paperwork. That's true. 4A, masters do not ask their slaves for benefits. That's true. Five, all state-offered paperwork is offered as a contract in commerce. That is true. Six, after all affairs are closed down associated with the state's numbers, package up all state contracts and send them back for cancellation by rescinding your use of their privileges. True. 7. Sell your labor by contract for pay. Do not use a Social Security number ever again for anything. True. 8. Become master over your life and government and demand that things be done your way. Do not compromise to your detriment to being a slave. True. 9. If necessary, eliminate all properties registered with the state. That's true. 10. Buy property you wish to own as a sovereign over the state in a lawful money account, gold and silver coin, with a contract and agreement, bill of sale, and do not register with the state. That's true. 10a, a lodial title is lawful bill of sale, lawful money by a sovereign, that's true. 11, most important, make God's laws my laws, that's true. 12, I show who I am serving, by whose law I study and keep, that's true. 13, as I depart Babylon, I will have the right to ask for their gold and silver, that's true. 14, debt to the system can be paid off with debt from the system, that's true. 15, I have a right to follow Christ's example and change my name, that's true. 16, one definition of birth is the beginning of existence, conception, and I have a right to use that as my birth date, true. 17, I have a right to qualify myself to travel in my personally owned automobile, that is true. 18, I have a right to identify property that I lawfully purchase as my property, including putting my own plate on my private automobile, that's true. 19, I have a right not to register anything with the state, that's true. 20, I have a right to declare independence from the state to secure my rights, that's true. 21, when I depart Babylon, I will have no government except God's government, and it is important that I make God's law, my laws, true. 22, four sovereign travelers, two each in two different privately owned place travel devices, with absolutely no government privileges, are traveling privately, not commercially in Washington, or maybe in the state where you're at. They are involved in a terrible accident. They crash into each other and two are killed. Would the government have a responsibility to bury the survivors? You must choose one of the two offered answers. And the two offered answers are true or false. So I want you just to think about that a second. Select an answer immediately. And you have to take true or false. There's no other way to answer this. It's got to be true or false. Okay, now, you've selected one of them. Well, I'll turn off your recorder just a second now. Select one of them. Now you can turn the recorder back on. Okay, now the answer is neither one of them, because you do not bury survivors. Question number 23, I always must do as I am told, false. In other words, when I make a command or a government employee makes a command that you do something that is total nonsense, you do not choose to do anything. You remain totally silent. So you don't always have to do as you are told. And if you have any comments to improve this test, we're open and welcome to hear those comments.